You know what I've been doing lately?
What have you been lately doing?
I've been playing Helldivers.
Oh, that. Okay, yes. Everyone on YouTube's playing Helldivers.
Yeah.
It's quite the
thing.
It's
very stressful.
I realized one of the reasons I am so bad at video games is that I will play a video game for 15 minutes, no matter the video game. I'll play it and be like, all right, I get this. And then I'll put it down. I won't need to play it anymore. I'm like, I get it. Okay. I get how it goes. All right. This is what it feels like to play the video game. Great. I was like, it's been years. I'm going to finally get into Alan Wake. So I get a copy of Alan Wake and I pop it on and I start playing. I'm like, all right, okay. And then 15 minutes in, I'm like, I don't need to play this anymore. I get it. You walk around, you do things. It's scary. All right, on to the next thing. That is my attention span with a video game. So I will continue playing my Tomb Raider phone game that I have. And that's the extent of my... It's a little Tomb Raider game. I used to have a Doom version of it. Now there's a Tomb Raider version of it. Anything that... Whatever I can get off Netflix's mobile apps store, I will play for free.
Yeah, I don't do that, as evidenced by the almost 2,000 hours I have in Pathfinder Wrath of the Righteous.
Oh, boy. I thought you were going to say in Smoke Jumpers or whatever the game is called.
No, I only have, like, 15 hours in Helldivers.
Oh, okay. Is it a science fiction game?
It's a satire commentary on democracy and America, basically. But it's also you shoot guns and kill.
But is it set in science fiction times?
Yeah, kind of.
Oh, okay.
It's set in the future.
I think Helldivers, I think of the people who dive into forest fires.
It's kind of based on that.
Okay.
Basically, you play as a soldier under... a Helldiver, and you get dropped onto planets to eradicate the enemies of democracy, basically.
Okay. Well...
It's fun.
Do you know what else might be a satire on democracy and American life? I guess. I don't know. It's The Asian Shore by Thomas Dish. I'm Phil.
And I'm Willow.
And it's Del Toro time. It's Del Toro time. It is Del Toro time. Yes, we are trucking towards the end of The Dark Descent. I'm looking behind myself because there might be a copy of the book behind me, but there isn't.
Don't worry, I have one right here.
You have
only the people who watch us exclusively on YouTube will be able to see the copy of the book.
And by exclusively, you mean available to anybody. We are only on YouTube. I have not set up a Vimeo account. So,
yeah.
But yes, you can watch us on YouTube if you're listening to us at home. And you could have seen Willow hold up the massive tome that is The Dark Descent. Yes, we're on the last stretch of the fabulous Formless Darkness. We are covering The Asian Shore by Thomas Dish, a author we have covered already.
We have. We covered his Roaches.
Yeah, which was about roaches.
It was about a woman who could communicate with roaches, and it was really upsetting.
It was a genuinely upsetting story, which had a genuinely upsetting comic book adaptation.
Yep.
But I remembered we enjoyed the roaches. Like it was a creepy little tale, and it ended with her like calling all the roaches to her.
New superhero unlocked.
As you do. Not unlike the movie Joe's Apartment, the MTV film about the man who has an apartment full of roaches. But this is a very different story. This is not a story of psychic powers. This is not a story of insect life. This is not a story of a woman in an apartment. It is about a man in an apartment.
The apartment stays true. It doesn't take place in New York, but it does mention New York a lot.
It mentions New York. It doesn't take place in America. It doesn't...
Do you think the roach lady exists in this continuity? Like, do you think all of the stories are secretly connected?
God, I hope so. I hope that there is a Thomas Dish verse out there just bubbling and percolating, waiting to come to American cinemas. As we remember from our last discussion, Thomas Dish was a prolific writer and adventurer, and he passed away, took his own life after the death of his longtime companion, his partner. I don't know if they were married or not. He had a lot of crap happen to him and exited this world unhappily. And as far as I can tell from everything everyone ever wrote, he seemed like a pretty stand-up guy. With a lot on his mind and a lot of very strong opinions about the way the world works. And he also wrote The Brave Little Toaster, and The Brave Little Toaster Goes to Mars.
Oh, that's right. That's right. That was him.
Yes. A man
of... One of the most horrifying movies of all time.
A man of many facets. But...
We watched that movie in Minneapolis, kids.
Yeah, it's a popular film.
And it was upsetting.
It's a genuinely...
I remember it being upsetting.
It's an unsettling film. It doesn't pull any punches. I mean, it's terrifying, especially if you are if you happen to be a toaster. It's
and
particularly
we all know,
frightening.
We all know that all children are secretly toasters.
Put in bread, toast pops out, kids.
Exactly.
So this story, The Asian Shore, was originally published in 1970 in the book Orbit 6, edited by Damon Knight, which is a collection of harder science fiction. Like stuff that's not really, you know, it's not breezy stuff to read. This is going to be more difficult sci-fi. It actually closes out the book. So
published in a book about sci-fi?
Yes, this is a science fiction. Because Dish was a sci-fi writer primarily. Like that's what people think of when they think of Thomas Dish is science fiction.
But this story was published in that.
Yes. The Asian Shore. Not The Brave Little Toaster. The Asian Shore. Does that surprise you?
Interesting. Yes.
How would you, so before we even talk about what this story is about, how would you classify this story?
Depressing.
Oh, really? You think this is a depressing tale?
I don't know. It's just, I didn't understand it. It just felt really, I reread it, and mm-hmm. It didn't become any clearer to me what was the point.
Is it that you didn't know what happened, or you didn't know why anything was happening?
Yeah, that, the second one. Like,
yeah.
I understood the sequence of events, it didn't make any sense to me.
So this is a story of yeah, it's well, what does our pal, the late great David G. Hartwell, have to say about this story? Like, if each one of these tales begins with an introduction by our illustrious late lamented editor David G. Hartwell, let us see what his thoughts were. And why
this is
he
the wrong story.
Why,
I was like, what is what?
Why did he include it in our book?
I'll just read the little block of text if that's okay.
Great.
Because I've tried to pick out segments of blocks of text and it's just it doesn't work. I can't
do it.
Yeah,
and they're short. This is short.
Thomas M. Dish's The Asian Shore is an extraordinary work of contemporary fiction about the nature of reality, about a singular transformation that is unsettling, disturbing, and perhaps horrifying. It goes one step beyond Henry James's The Holly Corner, portraying a unique doppelganger situation that is altogether beyond conventional psychological investigation of a character. It is not a category story, neither supernatural nor science fiction, though it emerged originally out of science fiction, or out of SF, where it was first published. It is printed here comfortably among its kin in our third stream of horror, where it represents the ambiguous boundary of horror with existential dread. Dish is not often mentioned as a horror writer, but he has, in fact, a significant body of fiction in such collections as Fun With Your New Head, Getting Into Death, 102 H-Bombs, and the novel The Businessman, a body of work that seems of growing importance to the contemporary horror field.
Yeah, I think that Dish's horror, except for the one about the woman who controls roaches with her mind, which seems fairly horrific in the sense that she commands the roaches to kill people, a lot of his horror seems to stem from this concept of identity, futility, the horrors of the world. I just read his story 1A, which is about a short story about a young man who enlists in the military because that's a way to, he wants a normal life. He sees his life going forward. He's going to get married, going to have some kids, going to get a job, settle down, be comfortable. But the first step to doing that once he graduates is to join the army. He joins the army. He witnesses horrific abuse at the hands of the drill sergeant, makes it into the first day of soldiering, stands at attention, and the entire platoon, his entire group is just mowed down by machine gun fire by the army, like, just to prove a point. Like, the army's like, you're better dead, and they kill everybody, the end. It's a very short story. And it's horrific and terrifying at the end because everyone just dies and then it's over. And I read that and I was like, that's, to me, the element of horror that we're dealing with here. Like the sort of like ambiguous futility of it. And this story is nothing if not ambiguous.
Yeah, I guess I just don't understand it.
Yeah.
Because I don't. None of it made like sense to me. I was like, this series of events that has occurred, why?
So, would you like me to summarize it real quick?
No, I can do it.
Okay, give us a quick summary. What basically happens in this story?
Basically, our narrator is visiting Turkey to write a book about his thesis on architecture,
yes.
Which is basically just everything is a set of rules and nothing means anything, I guess. I don't know. I didn't really get that either, but...
Wow. So if you don't get the thesis of his book, that I can understand then why the rest of the story wouldn't have fallen into place for
you. I tried to read his thesis 6 different times.
The basis of his thesis is that architecture is almost completely arbitrary because okay. Once you have walls and a roof, every single decision made after that is just arbitrary and pointless. It's just aesthetic. It doesn't function in any way. And so he's come to Istanbul to explore that because Istanbul is the only city in the world that is set on 2 separate continents, divided by mm-hmm. the Bosphorus River. There's a European shore and an Asian shore. And it's also the home of like a million different traditions because so many people have conquered this area.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to explore that. And unfortunately, it infects his mind. And he starts saying, well, if that's true of architecture, it has to be true of life as well. Beyond survival, every decision we make is arbitrary. That's the gist of that.
Then I have to say I agree with his ex-wife.
Okay, so what happens?
He is miserable mm-hmm. the entire time. It becomes winter. He falls into like a depression after a while. He sees this woman and this kid. They freak him out. She starts knocking on his door every night. He spirals even more. He hits her in the face. And at some point, seems something else happens. He goes to take some pictures. He comes back. The pictures are for some reason of a family gathering. I don't know what happens.
It's like you're describing the story in... as if you were told to describe the story, leaving out the quintessential points that fit the story together. The woman isn't just banging on his door. She's calling name Yavuz.
Yeah.
She seems to think he is someone else.
Yeah. And he meets this guy later on named Yavuz who has the same suit as him and looks similar to mm-hmm. him. And he's like, that's weird. And then doesn't do anything about that.
His name is John.
Yeah.
John Benedict Harris, which he keeps insisting. He's like, my name is John Benedict Harris. The gist is this woman seems to think he's someone named Yavuz. This little boy seems to think he is somehow connected to him. He doesn't speak the language, so he can't understand anything anyone's saying to him. He's completely alienated. This is a story about alienation and identity, in the most literal sense of the term, because as he becomes more and more, he's trying to hide himself in the culture, which involves mm-hmm. dressing the right way, growing his mustache out. He starts losing his sense of identity, but also wondering maybe he is this person named Yavuz. The thing with the photographs is he gets pictures developed from a trip he takes across the river. When he gets them developed, they're of a family hanging out together. The father, who is obviously the one taking the pictures, could very well be him because it's the woman and the boy who keep bothering mm-hmm. him. He hits the woman because he's freaking out at one point because
yeah, yeah.
she won't leave him alone. In the end of the story, he either chooses to or accepts his fate and becomes Yavuz and goes off with the woman and the boy. It's never explained.
But that doesn't make any sense.
The whole thing seems to be a tale of exploring the nature of identity and the choices we make in the world in which, like, the sort of duality. It's set in Istanbul for a reason. So Istanbul, separated by the Bosphorus River, set on it's the only, like I said, only city in the world set on two continents. It's just a split city. So like from the beginning, we have the notion of like these dual identities. Is there an actual Yavuz? Is it his doppelganger? Is it really him? Has he actually been living a dual life unknown to himself? It's never answered. I think the idea is that we're supposed to simply consider the nature of identity. What makes us us?
I think this is not a story for me. When it comes to stuff like, I think I just take things too literally sometimes. I also just don't get it.
Okay.
I think I have to disconnect myself from the logic of reality too much in order for me to understand this story.
Yeah.
Because it's so disconnected from how, like, the actions taken and explained are so disconnected from how I experience life.
Yeah. No, I can see that. I mean, there's a lot going on. Okay, so there's a lot of incident that happens throughout the story. We mentioned he buys a suit at one point. He doesn't care for it because it doesn't feel like the kind of thing he would wear, but it's very appropriate for the area.
Mm-hmm.
He goes to a movie at one point. Can you tell me about the movie he goes to
see? I can
tell
you about the movie.
Please,
like,
tell me.
It's like a vigilante-esque movie.
Mm-hmm.
I see the connection now. Where there's a guy who is an architect, who, like, he seems to be in love with a woman or whatever, but he's also like a vigilante or an anti-hero,
mm-hmm.
trying to get a hold of something. He kills a bunch of people, but there's two, in the end it turns out there's two of them. There's an evil one and a good one, and it's unclear which one dies at the end, and yada yada yada.
Yes. We have actually
called I don't know if it's pronounced differently because it's a name, but Killing in Istanbul or Killing in Istanbul.
Killing in Istanbul. We have actually discussed this, not this specific movie, but we have discussed this character on our show before.
We have.
Back when we discussed Danger Diabolik.
Oh, right.
We talked a bit about the history of these characters, these fumetti characters in Italy, who are all descendants from an original character named Fantomas, who was an anti-hero. And he inspired Diabolik. He inspired a criminal named Criminal.
Heck yeah.
With a K. And I remember us discussing that. And he inspired this character who is literally named Killing. Why? Because he kills. Also known as Satanic. Why? Because he's satanic. He's a man who dresses like a skeleton. He just dresses like a skeleton. And there were a number of movies based on the character. The movie special effects, by the way, created by Carlo Rambaldi, who also created the special effects for Possession. Yes, he created the octopus monster and E.T.
Oh, boy.
It all ties back. We all love it. We love it.
Officially brought it back to Guillermo del Toro.
We've officially brought it back to our friend Guillermo del Toro. He's a costumed vigilante. Not even a vigilante. He's a costumed anti-hero.
Yeah, I love anti-heroes. They're fun.
These are criminal characters who do what they do, just like Diabolik, do what they do for kicks and money. And yes, in this movie, there are two killings, a good one or a bad one and a worse one. And as you said, in the end, you're not sure which one. It's left ambiguous because he doesn't speak the language and there's no subtitles.
Mm-hmm.
It's ambiguous to him whether or not the bad killing survives or the worse killing survives. And I think that is very telling when it comes to the end of this story. Like, who is walking away at the end with the woman and the child? Is it Yavuz or is it John?
Somebody who needs significant mental health help.
This is a story that could take place all in this guy's head. Or, you know, it doesn't all take place in his head, but the perception could all be in his head. Presumably this woman exists.
She's interacted with other people before.
Okay, I couldn't remember.
He goes to a cafe. Like, the first time he hears her knocking, he goes to a cafe and she's knocking on the window and a person goes out and he's like, go away.
Oh, that's
like,
right. That's
you're disturbing
right.
people.
But again, she shows up at his house almost every night at 10 o'clock and for 30 minutes knocks on the door calling this guy's name, Yavuz, Yavuz, and no real person would do that, right?
No.
Like, that's not the way a person behaves. They would escalate, or they would give up, or they would change their tactics, not just constantly knock, saying one name over and over again. So there is, like, this surreal quality to her.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he first encounters her at a fort. Like, he does a lot of tourist stuff.
Yeah. Because he's trying to see the architecture so he could talk about his thesis. He's going, like, down a walkway or, like, a path or whatever. And it's, like, a narrow path, only enough for one person. And he steps off to the side so the woman can pass him.
Yeah.
And that's the total sum of their interaction.
And he, like, interprets, like, a million different things she does. She sort of, because he's like, oh, my God, she didn't cover her face when she walked past me. That's weird. But she kind of did. And then she kind of looked at me in a certain way, which maybe have meant this. But, like, it's, as far as we know, it's just a woman walking up a pathway.
Yeah.
And he sees her later on from, like, up on the fort. And he's like, oh, she's waving to me. Or is she? Or I don't know. And I've often wondered while reading this, is there actually a woman coming to his door, banging on the door?
Like, after I don't think that she was even at the fort the second time. Because there's no proof that she was. He takes a bunch of pictures, but he can't get the film developed because it keeps, like, breaking.
Yes, he keeps ruining his own film.
Yeah.
He first encounters the boy when he's in a city, and the boy is hauling water in bare feet. And the little boy is obviously asking for help.
Yeah.
But he's like, I can't talk to this boy because I don't speak the language. I don't want to interact with a child in a foreign country and have people, like, think it's weird. So I'm just going to back away. And
just get somebody else.
The little boy's like,
little boy's, like, clearly in pain because he's trying to pull water and it's winter. He only has flip-flops on. He's spilling water on his feet. He can't feel his...
But also... That may be his son.
Yeah.
Asking his father, what are you doing? Like, daddy, what's happening? Why are you backing away and, like, acting like a weirdo?
His son thinks that he's his father.
Or he thinks it's his father.
Because there is, in my mind, there's no way that this man is actually the guy that they think he is.
Why not?
Because he has an entire other life in the States.
Well, that's why I was like, because there's so much left out of the story, I'm like, did he go to Istanbul, have, like, some kind of a psychotic break, and, like, start a new life?
See, that one could make sense.
8 years ago, I guess. Like, we don't know how long he's been there either, because... But, like, he refuses to write his wife, who he has left. I mean, they're split up.
Janice. Because he wanted to go to Istanbul to work on his thesis. And she was like, first of all, no, what do you mean? Also, I completely disagree with your thesis.
Yeah.
And he was like, well, I'm going to go. And she's like, I want a divorce then.
And he keeps sitting down to write to her, but he's like, no. So
she writes to him, though.
That's true.
She gave him a Christmas postcard, and he got a letter, like a clipping of a review of his book sent to him.
Oh, that's true. That's true.
Which he, like, responds to later on in the story. So it can't have been that long.
It can't have been that long. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, it's a weird story. It's a surreal story. Is it a horror story? I mean, that's a stupid question. Clearly it is. It's in a horror collection, and it's labeled horror by many people. But
I don't feel the horror. I just feel sad. I just feel depressed.
I mean, sadness and depression are horrific.
I guess it feels more like a tragedy than a horror to me.
Tragedy can be horrifying.
Yeah, but the, like, genre, I guess he does say this is not a category story.
He does say that, yes.
Yeah.
You can kind of feel David Hartwell, like, hedging his bets on this one. Just like, look, I find this horrifying, and Dish has written some horrifying stuff. I'm including it here at the end.
I can see why it would be included in this collection, because I do think that it is a piece of the development of horror. I just don't consider it in it of itself to be a horror story.
It is. It's like, to me, if categories exist on a continuum, you know, and on this end is, like, I don't know, the bloody skeleton with the claws that drips acid and murders babies story. And on this end is, like...
I want to read that story.
Is, like, Boo, a Halloween ghost. a pop-up book for two-year-olds. And along this continuum is like horror.
I feel like this falls, I don't know if I would consider it a binary line,
though. It's not a binary line. It's all over. They go all over the place. I guess what I'm saying is it's very far in one. It's like, here are the elements of this. Mm-hmm. Some versions of this story are far more clearly horrific. Like,
yeah,
in their implications. This one, I feel, is very far on the, like, vaguer end of the of that line.
I think I didn't feel horrified by anything that happened in this story. It just felt sad.
Maybe the real horror is that poor boy's feet.
Yeah, I mean, that's like the only part of this story that I was like, oh, yikes. Except for the part where he hits the woman across the face.
He does hit the woman across the face, which is uncalled for, but also he's going insane. I can't tell. It's this terrifying, to me, this is the scariest part, is he's trying to catch a ferry back to...
Yeah, that made me feel a little, like,
He's on the, his apartment is on the European side of the river, mm-hmm. hence the Asian shore. He keeps seeing the Asian shore. And he's crossed the river, and now he's trying to get back to the European side, but he keeps missing, like, things keep occurring that cause him to...
felt like a dream. The entire last segment of the story felt like a nightmare that he had while he was sleeping on the ferry to go to the other side.
You know what it felt like? It kind of felt to me like the ending of Brazil almost. Like that.
Oh, yeah.
Things just kind
of. Which also felt like a dream.
Well, yeah, it is. It's literally a dream. Spoilers. It's a dream.
It's a dream.
But it's. It is that sense of, like, things are getting weirder and weirder and weirder, except in this version, he doesn't wake up, and he's just like, I guess I'm a Turkish guy now.
Yeah, I guess I feel like the ending of this story is a dream. It just feels like a nightmare to me. Like, the whole segment of it, like, even him, like, leaving, because he isn't supposed to be leaving yet. Like, it feels like he got drunk in his apartment, which he's been doing, he fell asleep, and now he's dreaming this entire last segment.
The real question we need to ask at the end, though, is what does his new wife think of his thesis?
Probably not much.
He can't talk to her.
Yeah. That was also a weird part, like the weird part of the story to me, because that was anxiety inducing. Just not being able to speak the language at all.
Yeah. It is very much a story about anxiety, too, mm-hmm. like, and being trapped. But he's not even trapped in this. He chose to come here.
Yeah, he chose to come here, and he could literally leave at any time.
That's true. That's true. But he doesn't. He doesn't. Sorry. Sorry, John.
Yeah, I mean, and the end of the story, he's not even referred to by name. He's just called the man.
Who?
Our main character.
Well, he's called John.
No, the end of the story. The man nodded suddenly at the woman who mumbled a few rapid words of Turkish. They set off, as they had so many times before, toward their home, the man leading the way, his wife and son following a few paces behind, taking the road along the shore. So it's not even clear if it's him.
Right. So there's a lot...
It's not him at the end. It's whatever weird thing has happened to him.
So there's a lot to be said about the story and the themes of, like, cultural displacement, self... Like, not self-image, but, like, self, like, the sense of self, I guess, who you are. I was worried when I first started reading it. These worries were assuaged. I was worried that it was going to be one of those stories that sets our protagonist in a foreign land, especially in the East, and then over-exoticizes, like, makes that the horror. Like, you're in this crazy world that no white man can understand. And... it almost starts doing that until you realize that, like, no, Istanbul's fine. It's our protagonist that's got the issues. And
yeah. You know what? I just figured out I'm having the same reaction to this story that I had the first time I saw Rosemary's Baby. It made me incredibly uncomfortable, and I'm not, like, processing that.
It's an uncomfortable story. I like that he makes a friend. He has this one friend who I kept thinking was going to end up being a weirdo.
But he wasn't. He was just a nice guy.
He's just a guy who literally helps him, like, buy a new suit and barter with people and figure out where he needs to go. But you kept expecting this guy to turn or be...
Peppa Pig.
I just punched Peppa Pig. And no, and I think that's what I mean when I say, like, this doesn't turn... As much as Istanbul is a character in this story, it doesn't turn Istanbul into the villain. He's not trapped... Like we said, he's not trapped in Istanbul. He's not done in by the city. He's just a man who has no sense of identity anymore.
Yeah. I think, I'm not sure there is a villain in this story.
Yeah, except for himself.
Yeah. Well, even himself, I don't think he's really a villain. I think he's right. Incredibly mentally ill, which, I mean, just breaking down his actions that led him into this situation, he completely uprooted his life, divorced his wife all to chase a thesis that kind of made him spiral into, like, a mental breakdown. It kind of seems like he's a guy going through a lot at his time. Like, it kind of feels like a midlife crisis almost.
It is the worst midlife crisis. Yeah. Yeah, he's having the worst midlife crisis. And I think that that's not even a joke. Like, mm-hmm. I think because what is a midlife crisis if not a person suddenly going, who even am I?
Yeah.
Like, why do I exist? Do I exist, or is every choice I've made completely arbitrary?
Yeah.
Would it matter if I suddenly decided I was a Turkish man named Yavuz and went off with a woman I'd never met? Because that's just as specific and meaningful a choice as every other choice I've made in my life. And isn't that...
I hate it. I hate that line of thinking. I think it's dumb.
Because you know it's true.
No.
Because you know it's true. You could be in Turkey right now.
No. I think that what really irks me about this story is how far removed it is from the way that I view life.
Yeah.
Which makes sense, and it's good to challenge myself by reading stuff like this. It just made me very deeply uncomfortable, which I guess it's supposed to do.
It's supposed to do that.
It's a successful story. I won't be reading it again, probably.
I also think it might be one of those stories that makes more sense in the context of Thomas Dish's mm-hmm. body of work. Like, if you read a bunch of Dish and
remembering that he wrote The Roaches, this or whatever that story's called, I think it's The Roaches.
Mm-hmm.
It makes more sense to me.
Mm.
Because that story was also I can see the similar like connections and themes between the two stories.
Yeah.
I feel like in order for me to fully grasp this story, I'd want to know more about Dish.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot to know about him. He wrote so much. There's so much Dish out there.
Yeah. I think that this story would be really good to talk about in like a class.
Oh, yeah. A class on horror, a class on science fiction, a class on Istanbul, a class
on... Just a class on literary theory.
On literary things. Yeah, it's a very talkable story. And it's not terribly long. I thought it was going to be really long.
No, it was a quick read despite, like, it was long. Like, it's not, like, super long, but it was long.
Yeah, it's a novelette or a whatever.
It's broken into chapters again. I like when stories are broken into chapters.
Yeah, easier to keep track of.
Yeah, it's about 25 pages long.
Well, it probably comes as no surprise to you that this story's never been adapted into anything.
Wow, really?
It's not a single ding-dang thing. You're gonna have to just pop in your video of The Brave Little Toaster Goes to Mars again if you want to catch any more Dish on screen.
I think that somebody could do an adaptation of this story.
Yeah, you would just have to get you'd have to really film in Istanbul, I think, just to make it authentic.
I think that this is a very adaptable story, which is, I don't say about a lot of these stories. But it's so much, this is about a man. It's not about a monster or anything. It's about a man. And I think film would be a really good way to adapt this story.
All right. Well, get to it.
No.
Get on that. I want to see it. I want it on my desk by tomorrow at 3:30.
Main character played by Chris Pratt. Let's go.
Let's go. Well, speaking of Chris Pratt, what is the next story in The Dark Descent?
It's actually a Garfield cartoon, believe it or not. No.
He hates Mondays. He loves lasagna.
It's The Hospice by Robert Aichman.
Robert Aichman's Garfield in the Rough. In
the
which
hospice.
John, Garfield, and Odie go camping, and they're chased by a panther? I think that's what happens in
We've
that story.
We've read a few Robert Aichman stories in here.
We have.
We read Larger Than Oneself.
Mm-hmm.
We read The Swords.
We did.
I think that's it.
Yep.
Yep. There's at least one in each book.
And I think I've said each time to live like the Aichman, to be like the Aichman.
I don't think you've ever said that.
I have said that to myself many times. yes, he wrote Larger Than Oneself, which remains one of my favorite stories in this collection, mm-hmm. and The Swords, which remains a story in this collection. So, next time we'll be covering our final Aichman story. Well, what's
For
it
now.
Called again? What's it called?
The Hospice.
The Hospice.
Which is an intriguing title.
It is an intriguing title. Two more stories, and then we're done with this. Can you believe it?
No, I can't. It's been literal years.
It's been literal years. It's been literally been years.
Because we started this during COVID. We started this during the beginning of the pandemic.
We did. And now the pandemic is, I guess, still going on, but we're almost done with the stories. So then we'll move on to movies, and who knows
what
the
future... Then we'll go back to stories.
Who knows what the future will bring. You know what I got a copy of?
What?
That Guillermo del Toro book we were talking about, the Chuck Hogan Guillermo del Toro one. I got a copy of it up there now.
Heck yeah. Did you get the copy of the book... that I wanted to...
has not come in yet, so I'll probably be in on Sunday when I go to work, so we'll see what happens. This is personal talk with Willow and Phil.
I talked about Helldivers at the beginning of this episode, so
that's true. A game I still know nothing about except that it is a game and I will never play it.
It's fun.
I'll play it when I'm done with Alan Wake 2, which is a game I don't even own. So but yes, you can also listen to my shows Deep in Bear Country or Pizza Toast, which will be coming back shortly. But this is our show. It's Del Toro Time, right up there above my head, if you're watching on YouTube. Thank you, everybody, so much for listening. Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back with more exciting spookiness in the future. Hopefully. I don't know if this next story is scary.
I wish... Yeah, this story upset me. And made me want to hate it. So, congratulations.
We'll be back next week with Boo, a Halloween Ghost, a pop-up book for two-year-olds. But until then, I am Phil.
And I'm Willow.
And we'll see you when it's Del Toro time.
Bye.